This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Sam, in our show preview email today for Three Strikes, wrote, quote, "Holding out for Real Muto trade before we record." And literally, as we were setting up our equipment to start recording today, we got the push notification that the JT Real Muto trade had gone through. Nice work.
Yeah, no.
Well done.
A lot of this had been rumored throughout the day. We're recording this on Thursday this week, a little bit different than we normally do. And I'm thankful for that now, because this trade would have been made anything we recorded yesterday obsolete. A lot of rumblings throughout the day that Sixto Sanchez and Jorge Alfaro were going to be going to Miami for JT Realmuto. Realmuto was kind of the big blockbuster trade we've all been waiting for this offseason. Obviously, some signings, by some I mean quite a few, signings still out there on the free agent market. But this was the big trade I think we were all waiting to happen. And the fact that it finally happened today is kind of good, because that means we can turn one page on the offseason. Would love to see everything else kind of fall into place from here. But the fact that this went down today, it feels good. It feels like a good prep for next week when pitchers and catchers report.
So we're going to talk about that here in a minute, and welcome in to this week's episode, the 195th of the Show Before the Show podcast from MILB.com. My name is Tyler Mon. The voice on the other side is Sam Dykstra. We're talking all things minor league baseball and a lot to get to this week. Before we get to all of this, the news broke just a little while ago as well that Hall of Famer Frank Robinson passed away. He was the first African-American manager in Major League Baseball, a 500 home run club member, very nearly a 600 home run club member. He had 586 homers in his illustrious major league career. And the one thing I love about Frank Robinson is he is one of those guys in baseball history who it feels like everybody who came across him, who played with him or who played under him when he was a manager or who worked with him, everybody has a Frank Robinson story, which I think is really cool. And the admiration for not only his career, but the type of man he was, what he did in the civil rights movement, being the first black manager in Major League Baseball history, a pretty incredible career, a pretty incredible life. And obviously our thoughts with his family. Passed away at 83 years old, Frank Robinson. Rest in peace, one of the all-time greats in Major League Baseball history.
Yeah, and just last week, you know, we were talking about Jackie Robinson's legacy in the minors, previously on the show we had talked about that. And Frank Robinson right up there with, you talk about trailblazer in baseball. I think Jackie Robinson's name is there first. Frank Robinson's name is right alongside there. A guy who won MVP in both the AL and the NL, first black manager, as you mentioned. This is Black History Month, and it's a time when we look back on our history and see which African Americans have really improved our country and taken it to some of the better places we've ever been. And Frank Robinson was right there in terms of our sport of baseball. And like you mentioned, somebody who you just bring up his name to certain baseball folk and you just have to pull up a chair and just listen for the next 15 minutes, because people are going to go off with all sorts of fun, crazy Frank Robinson stories. So great player, good manager. Really sad to see him go, and I'm sure more of those stories will come out here in the days and weeks to come as we continue to remember Frank Robinson.
So with that, we'll get started on Three Strikes for this week's episode of the Show Before the Show, and we will kick it off with some baseball discussion on the field, which it feels like, well, I guess the move technically happens off the field. It'll affect a lot of what goes on the field. My point is, we're not talking about like rankings or something. There's a big trade that went down a short time ago, and this from MLB.com today, quote, The Phillies have agreed to acquire standout catcher JT Realmuto from the Marlins for catcher Jorge Alfaro, right-hander Sisto Sanchez, left-hander Will Stewart, and $250,000 in international bonus slot money, sources told MLB.com on Thursday. The deal, which is pending completion of physicals, has not been confirmed by either club. We know for a while that the Marlins were really kind of asking for the moon in trade discussions with teams. For a long time, it seemed like the Phillies were not going to part with Sanchez, the right-hander, in this discussion, in this deal. That obviously changed, and it appears as of right now that that is where this deal is headed. Sanchez last year with Class A advanced Clearwater went 4-3 with a 2.51 ERA and 46 and two-thirds innings. He also missed a lot of time, right elbow inflammation, had a sore collarbone that kept him out of the Arizona Fall League, but he's a guy who, on the maybe crazy side comparison-wise, people have compared to Pedro Martinez. He's not the biggest dude on the planet, but a right-hander who throws gas. He's been clocked in the mid to upper 90s pretty consistently throughout his career, and he is really the prize piece of this deal that goes to Miami. On the other side, the Phillies obviously get the best catcher in baseball. We're going to talk about this from the prospect side. Sanchez, I think, does it come as a surprise to you that the Phillies got to the point where they gave him up? And where does that leave your evaluation of what the Phillies are at this stage in the offseason? Because we went into this offseason hearing all these big rumblings. They've got stupid money. The Phillies are going to sign everybody. Haven't signed anybody. And the deal that they've made now is a trade in which they give up their top prospect.
Well, I won't say that they haven't signed anybody. They signed Andrew
not quote unquote anybody.
Right, but, not upper tier. Like, they brought in Andrew.
Not Manny,
McCutcheon,
not Bryce Harper.
Yeah, which is a big signing for them. But they, you know, they did miss out on Patrick Corbin. Manny Machado and Bryce Harper are still out there. For whatever reason, they haven't yet signed with the Phillies. Whether that's the Phillies haven't forked over enough money, which, given the way this offseason has gone, kind of seems like that's the issue with basically all the free agents at this point, is that they haven't had their requests met. Or is it the Phillies just didn't look enticing enough to sign there? If it's the latter, well, acquiring JT Realmuto, who last year led all of Major League Baseball catchers in WAR, I think he was 4.6, and nobody else was really close. Grandal was like second, 4.8, excuse me. Grandal was second at 3.6, so he was pretty head and shoulders above Grandal last year as baseball's best catcher. You know, some people still think Buster Posey's in that conversation. I get it. We don't need to rank these in terms of that, but Realmuto, 2 years left before he hits free agency. Some real value there, really going to hit his prime. And if that's going to happen, you do have to kind of pay through the nose. Now, you brought up, what does this make us think about Sixto Sanchez? You know, why would the Phillies be willing to give him up? The fact that they did is kind of telling to me, because you mentioned his health concerns. He had right elbow inflammation that held him out for a lot of 2018. Just when he's about to come back for the AFL, has a collarbone issue, then they keep him out of that as well. When you're 6 foot tall and a pitcher, you know, and these injuries start to pick up, it becomes worrisome. And nobody's going to know Sixto Sanchez's health better than the Phillies. I mean, they're the ones who are getting him all these physicals. They're the ones who have held him out because of health. If they're willing to part with him, that causes me to put the brakes a little bit on his prospect profile. Now, when he is healthy, his arsenal might be one of the best we have among pitching prospects right now. It might be up there with a Forrest Whitley or even an Alex Reyes when he is healthy. His fastball, as you mentioned, hits upper 90s, could hit 100 at times. The curveball, the changeup are above average pitches, but what really sticks out to me is his control. It's one thing to throw upper 90s, but as we see so many times often with relievers, if you have that gas, you sometimes don't know where the ball is going. Sixto Sanchez really knows where the ball is going. His command, his control is really special. He's only walked 4.9% of the batters he's faced in minor league baseball so far. That being said, he's still yet to crack triple digits in innings pitched for a season. This kind of holds off on that a little bit. I know some Phillies fans aren't excited to trade Alfaro, and Alfaro's not a prospect anymore, so I'll kind of put him off to the side here. But you're giving up somebody who might be 80% of Realmuto and putting on Sixto Sanchez on top of that. I think there's just a lot of risk that the Phillies are giving up for getting somebody who's a surefire thing. And if they are really going to push for an NL East that the Braves showed last year, pretty open, this is a time to kind of get it right now. And the Mets, you know, have improved, and the Nationals are probably going to bounce back. Adding Patrick Corbin is going to be a big help there. This is a wide open NL East, and the Phillies need to make more moves like this. If this is the first one, okay, now you need to start throwing that stupid money around that you promised. Now it's really time to put up or shut up. So the Phillies are a more interesting team now. The system's a little less interesting, but Sanchez going to Miami, you know, he's the prospect they kind of needed. I think they wanted that in Victor Mesa as being like, okay, he's the number one prospect for us. He's kind of the guiding light that everybody can look to and say, see, we have a cornerstone of our farm system. And then he checks in, you know, low 90s of top 100 lists if he appears at all. He comes in at number 99 on MLB.com. So bringing in Sanchez, who's number 27, is somebody who they can now point to and say, here's a guy who will lead us, who he will be the future front of our rotation. Hopefully alongside Sandy Alcantara and Jorge Guzman, guys they picked up last offseason who also have serious, you know, elite velocity. Wouldn't that be a fun rotation to see, you know, three guys bring in right in a row in 2021, say, all of whom could hit 100. That's going to be really tough for opposing teams. A lot has to go right there. You know, Guzman is still in the lower minors. Alcantara has gotten some looks in the majors, but he's still a prospect. Sanchez hasn't seen double A yet and still has those health concerns. So, you know, this is, I think Miami should be happy with what they got back. It's a little riskier than maybe what they were hoping for, but now they do have that one guy that they can point to their fans and say, here he is, you know, here's somebody you can all look to and get excited about for the immediate future. You know, after Monte Harrison, Eason Diaz kind of saw their stock slip a little bit last year, and Lewis Brinson didn't fulfill his potential in the major leagues. I'm still, you know, bullish on Lewis Brinson long term, but seeing some of these prospects they picked up last year not work out, they need somebody new, somebody fresh to kind of to look at, and Sixto Sanchez can be that for the Miami Marlins here, starting, you know, when he reports here in a couple of weeks.
We don't talk about things on the major league side so much, but I know before this deal went down, the Phillies were still projected via Fangraphs somewhere around, I think, 78 wins and in fourth place in the National League East. Do you think this deal, just on a quick note on the major league side, do you think this deal is enough to push them into the conversation to contend in that division?
Not this deal alone, no. It helps. It certainly helps. You know, I think they could be a good team. I think they overperformed a little bit last year. Adding potentially the best player at a position, never going to hurt. Giving up Sanchez, who wasn't going to help in 2019, is not going to hurt. Giving up Alfaro, you know, feels like it might hurt because you had to tie in some prospects and some money. But Realmuto is such a clear advantage over him that I wouldn't worry about that. Are they there yet to catch up to the Braves, the Nationals, and the Mets? They still need to make that other move, and I think if they are being this aggressive, that means they are being that aggressive as well in free agency. That'll still yet to reveal itself, but they still need to take other steps. This can't be it alone by any means.
Jacob Tyler, by the way, in case you're wondering what the JT stood for, which I know you all were. Strike two this week, as we will move along, and Phillies fans fired up. They no longer have one of the names that we may have discussed in this topic, but pitchers and catchers report within the next week, and this is a good topic that Sam kicked off for strike two. In honor of pitchers and catchers reporting, what is your favorite battery or potential battery in the minor leagues this year, your favorite pitcher-catcher combo?
All right, so for me, if we're looking at guys who are actually probably going to play with each other, I mean, we could play this game all we want and say, like, Joey Bart and a Giants pitcher, but Giants pitchers aren't that exciting. Or Francisco Mejia and, you know, somebody like Luis Patino in the Padres system, but they're not going to play together for a while. Hopefully Mejia is going to be on a Major League opening day roster. Luckily, when it comes to exciting catching prospects and exciting pitchers, I don't think we have to go that far, really, to say two guys who absolutely have a chance to play with each other early and often in 2019.
I think we're on the same page with this.
Were you going to say Sean Murphy and Jesus Luzardo as well?
I absolutely was.
So that's good. I mean, agreement is good. You know, heck with all these other debate shows in which everybody's yelling at each other. The fact that we can come to an agreement is pretty good.
I'm with you.
So do you have any hot takes you want to say about this, or do you want me to just go off?
I will say one thing. I'm not sure Jesus Luzardo spends time in the minor leagues this year. That will be my hottest of hot takes. But if he doesn't, you know who else might get a chance to throw a little bit to Sean Murphy, depending on his timetable and when he returns, is A.J. Puck, who is another fun arm in that organization. So those are my two hot takes. A.J. Puck could get his way back onto a mound quickly. He could be thrown to Sean Murphy at some point. Or Jesus Luzardo is already maybe the most entertaining pitcher in minor league baseball, and if he's not on a big league opening day roster, he could be the guy.
Yeah, no, that's definitely true. The reason why we pick Murphy and Luzardo is because Murphy right now is the number four catching prospect in baseball, according to MLB.com. Luzardo is, I believe, number one when it comes to left-handed pitchers. The excitement is more from Luzardo's point of view, obviously. Luzardo has a chance to be, you know, a number two starter maybe in the major leagues, plus fastball, good curveball, really good changeup. And again, like we were mentioning with Sixto Sanchez, plus control that makes the whole package play up. He was coming into the last year. We thought he was going to start out at Class A. He ends up starting out at Class A Advanced, climbs all the way to Triple A Nashville. So this year he'll probably start right back there at Triple A Las Vegas. Vegas is now an A's affiliate, which is kind of exciting as they move into their new stadium, as you'll hear Ben talk about later. But, you know, he just has all these different weapons he can throw at guys. I know he struggled a little bit in his first taste of the PCL last year, but I thought he could have pitched in the major leagues in September. Obviously, you want to hold him back a little bit. He threw 109 in third innings. He's somebody who has Tommy John on his profile, but you know, Luzardo just has so many weapons. And the fact that what makes this partnership so exciting to me is that Murphy is what makes him a good prospect is his glove. He's supposed to be a really good receiver, a really, really good thrower, so he can control the running game. This isn't just, you know, if we were pairing him up like some of those other guys I brought up before from the catching position, it might just be like, yeah, he throws to this guy and then that guy goes and hits very well. And that's an exciting partnership for that. Murphy can be a pretty good hitter, but that's not where his, you know, value is going to come from. In many ways, he could end up being like the catching version of Matt Chapman in Oakland. Anybody who saw Matt Chapman play last year knows his glove is really, really special there at third base. I think Murphy could be right there alongside him. Maybe not quite as good because Chapman was so elite and at an actual fielding position. But Murphy is going to do incredible things working with the pitching staff. Teaming him up with Luzardo is only going to help those two. And I think if they both make the majors this year, which they are both poised to do if they start out at Triple-A, you know, that's a partnership that the A's would love to see continue and foster itself, and it'll make both more comfortable. You know, when you're no longer just catching a major league pitcher who you have to remember how you caught him in the spring, or if you're a pitcher and you're throwing to a catcher and you're like, okay, like, what is his pitch sequence going to be? Am I going to have to shake him off a bunch? When you already have that established relationship, that's only going to help. So Luzardo, Murphy, I expect them to be there probably by July, both of them together in Oakland. And if Puck can come a long way in his recovery as well and be right alongside them, that would be really, really good for the future of Oakland at a time when, you know what, they surprised a lot of people last year too, and their projections aren't going to be as rosy going into 2019, but if they're going to match what they did last year, it's going to take these prospects coming up and performing as well as they can. So that'll be an exciting look to see some of these guys come up together to the Bay Area.
And strike three this week. Prospect projections continued. Sam's Toolshed column rolling through all six divisions and wrapping things up with the National League West. Some interesting talent in the National League West. Sam rolls through the one of the most competitive divisions in baseball in recent seasons. Who's going to stand out this year?
Yeah, so this one, as I was starting to put together some of the tables using Steamer 600 numbers, I was thinking like, oh, you know, maybe I'll write about Alex Verdugo because the Dodgers outfield is a little more open now. Or, hey, Brendan Rodgers' war projection is a little bit higher than I would have thought. Okay, well, that's interesting. And the Rockies infield, as you know, Tyler, could be a little bit in flux in 2019. Maybe that's what I'll lead with. And then it hit me and I got to San Diego and I was just like, oh, right.
Oh, right. They have everybody. Exists.
Yeah, they have everybody. So that was the obvious kind of lead in. So I wrote a little bit about that for the site and that's up now. But just to kind of go over that, the way things are looking here for opening day, you know, Fernando Tatis Jr. is obviously the top prospect in that system. He's number two overall. Tools across the board. People think he can stick at shortstop. We've seen it, you know, last year at AA in San Antonio. We saw it this winter in the Dominican Winter League. You know, really exciting stuff from him. His projection might not be as rosy as everybody was thinking. I kind of get that. And when I started to put this together, you know, his projection of 1.6 WAR and a 233, 293, 387 slash line, not exactly great. Somebody you're hoping to be the future of the franchise. I understand that. That being said, Steamer still thinks he would be the best shortstop for San Diego right away, which tells you something about the way they've constructed the roster right now, and tells you basically about his major league readiness. So seeing that is kind of interesting, but it's not just him. Luis Urias got major league time at the end of last year. Maybe he holds down shortstop until Tatis is ready, and then he slides over to second base. They signed Ian Kinsler this offseason. Basically with that idea, Kinsler can play second, but maybe he moves over to third by the time Tatis is ready and Urias moves over to second. That'll be interesting. Francisco Mejia, they expect him to be the best catcher for the Padres over a full season, which is interesting because Austin Hedges is also in that system. Austin Hedges, for a while there, everybody thought he would be the long-term solution for catcher. For the Padres, really good defensive player, has shown some offensive outbursts here and there, but is not a consistent offensive performer, especially in the way Mejia could be. So to see Mejia ahead of him in terms of projection tells us something that maybe Mejia really should be going into camp as the odds-on favorite to be the opening day catcher. So as much as we think of this Padres system as being especially young, especially when it comes to pitching, on the position player side, a lot of these guys are ready right now. I think Tatis is going to start the year at AAA. Not exactly worried about that, especially last year when he was coming off injury that made him miss basically half the year. But you know, he's somebody who could force his way probably by the Super 2 deadline. I kind of hope he's only there for a couple of weeks. What he was able to do at the end of last year with making adjustments and the way he was able to perform this year against, you know, advanced competition down there in his native Dominican Republic was really cool. I don't really think he needs that much seasoning. Padres might disagree. They might want to just see that sustained for a little bit longer. But given this projection, given that he is the best shortstop in the system right now, would not be surprised if he pushes his way up there by late April, early May. And these Steamer projections kind of back that up. One pitcher I do want to talk about, though, and I brought this up a little bit last week, at least in my writing, when I was talking about the AL West, and I talked about how Josh James could be one of the best rookie pitchers over a full season next year, or this upcoming season, rather. But above him was actually Chris Paddock. And for anybody who reads the site regularly, you'll know Chris Paddock was our Milby starting pitcher of the year last year. Incredible control, really good strikeout rates, everything that Steamer's just going to love and Steamer thinks is really translatable to the next level. If he were to get a full season at the majors, which nobody is thinking he will, he finished the year at AA. But if he were to do that, Steamer thinks he would be worth 3.9 WAR, which is not just a good major league starter. That's almost a great major league starter. They expect him to strike out 9.3 batters per nine innings, so more than one batter per inning, putting up a 3.52 ERA and a 3.48 WHIP. Or a FIP over 200 innings. Those are really, really good numbers.
I think a lot of that is kind of skewed a little bit because Paddock was coming off Tommy John surgery last year and the Padres limited him. So, you know, he wasn't seeing batters necessarily three times in the way you would expect him to in a major league lineup in 2019. But, you know, somebody who's got a really good fastball, a really good changeup, the breaking ball is really the only thing he's waiting on because that control is really good. If he can develop some sort of breaking ball, that's a bona fide major league starter. Steamer thinks he's already that right now and might be the best one on San Diego staff, period. So, you know, when we're looking at 2019 for the Padres, I think we all agree it's going to continue to be a rebuilding year. But if Tatis, Mejia, Urias are all major league players by the end of May, by June, if Paddock is up in that rotation as well, if some of these other guys, Logan Allen, forces his way up there, maybe Cal Quantrill beats his projections because they weren't too great. They were just around one WAR for him. It's possible that they push up this timeline by a year, and we're talking about the Padres being in maybe an 80, 85 win team this year if all these prospects hit like they have the potential to do this year, and the projections kind of back that up a little bit.
So that's three strikes for this week's episode, number 195 of the show before the show. Blockbuster deal already in the books today, and probably a whole lot more, maybe not trades like that, but there's a lot to come, you get the feeling, before even before pitchers and catchers report coming up in the next week. We will cover all of it for you as it pertains to prospects here on the official podcast of MILB.com. Coming up, we're going to talk some business stuff with Benjamin Hill, who joins the show next. A lot of big stuff this week around the business world of minor league baseball. Benjamin Hill joins us to discuss it all. Promo schedules are out. We've got some ballpark news. We've got some team renaming news. Hello, Ben. Busy week this week.
It is. And hello, Tyler. And hello, Sam Dykstra. Sitting to my right, we are at a round table today. So this is a literal round table discussion.
Wow.
Yeah. And Sam forgot the mic. So he's like holding it up in my face. And I'm close.
Yeah, I'm this time around.
Yeah, and I'm closer to Sam than I usually am, both emotionally
you guys are
like
and backup physically. Singers?
Yeah, if you can imagine what that whole like scrum was to get Tom Brady at the end of the Super Bowl, that's basically like what we have in this conference room right now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But we don't have any outside forces pushing us together.
It's just okay. It's just ourselves.
Yeah.
It's just you're just drawn to each other. Well, let's get started. The story that is up on MILB.com this week from Ben is a batting around column, which has a look at ballpark improvements for the 2019 season. Now, we know that there are new ballparks that are opening. Fayetteville, North Carolina will play host to the Fayetteville Woodpeckers for the first time, the Buies Creek Astros. Moving over there, as was always the plan when that franchise basically, in effect, moved from the California League. And elsewhere around the minor league baseball world, the Sod Poodles of Amarillo, Texas, they will likewise be opening a ballpark. What else is going on?
Yeah, you know, this is a new batting around column, and I can't say this column, you know, provides any like, whoa, major news, but I try to do one about once a month just to keep everyone up to date and keep myself up to date on things that are going around. So yeah, we have these three new ballparks. We always knew the one in Vegas was going to be called Las Vegas Ballpark, which is kind of interesting because that's a naming rights deal with like the Las Vegas, you know, visitors and convention authority or something like that. So that's a strange one. But now we have two more ballpark names. In Amarillo, it is Hodgetown, which when you think about ballpark names, Hodgetown is a anomalous name. And it's right. It's named in honor of a local businessman and philanthropist and someone who's been agitating to bring minor league baseball back, a man named Jerry Hodge. So this ballpark is called Hodgetown. So, you know, you go to a game and like, hey, let's go to Hodgetown today. So
it's not Hodgetown Ballpark.
No, it's not Hodgetown Ballpark or Hodgetown Stadium or what have you. It's just Hodgetown.
I kind of like that. I like those different spins on it and stuff like that. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah, yeah. And then Fayetteville, they just announced this morning, we're speaking here on Thursday, this morning they announced they're going to be playing in Segra Stadium. And I know it's hard to get excited about explicit, you know, corporate naming rights names, but it is the reality of the business. But Segra is a one of the largest independent fiber bandwidth companies in the U.S. And if you really pay attention to these things, you might remember that just last month, the Columbia Fireflies, who play in Spirit Communications Park, changed their name to Segra Park. And that's because Segra is part of a is the result of some merger that involves Spirit Communications. And I don't keep track of these things too much in detail. But now, you know, when we were talking, when 2019 began, a more innocent, simpler time, we had no Segra ballparks in the minor leagues. Now we have two, one in South Carolina. We have Segra Park in Columbia, South Carolina, and now in the new ballpark in Fayetteville, Segra Stadium. So if you're into independent bandwidth, I guess this is a good day for you. And that column also, you know, goes over some improvements to ballparks that we can expect in 2019. You know, Binghamton got a $5.1 million improvement plan. Bowling Green Hot Rods have a couple million dollars going into their park. Same with Oklahoma City Dodgers, Chickasaw Bricktown Ballpark. You know, so you got various things, new playing surfaces, new video boards. And going back to Las Vegas, and as you guys know, following the world of minor league baseball, whenever a video board is announced, it always seems like, oh, this is the biggest ever, or it's the best resolution, or the most pixels, or whatever. And there's always this kind of like, my video board is bigger than yours thing going on all around the minors. But Las Vegas flat out said, bam, we now have the largest video board in minor league baseball, 31 feet high by 126 feet wide. So apparently the largest in all of minor league baseball and top 25 in baseball in North America. So Vegas, I don't know what major league ballparks have smaller video boards, but apparently Vegas will have larger video boards than certain currently unnamed major league ballparks. But check out Batting Around for a full roundup of all this stuff. There's a lot of tidbits and notes and bites and bits and whatever you want to call it.
And beyond just like little bites that we're getting about stadium news, we got some bigger kind of wave this week in terms of promo news, with a lot of teams kind of announcing what's coming up for the 2019 season for them in the promo department. A lot of interesting ones. One of the ones that stands out to me is the Maine Whoopie Pies, the Portland Sea Dogs. That sets up a battle between them and Reading. They're actually playing Reading, right? Isn't that the deal?
Yeah, yeah. The Reading Fightin' Phils in 2017, as part of the craze that most everyone, well, I'm sure a lot of the listeners to this podcast are already well aware, the temporary naming craze of a regional food item. In 2017, Reading, laying claim to being like the birthplace of the Whoopie Pie, which is like a moon pie kind of, it's a marshmallow. What is a Whoopie Pie, Sam?
I mean, it's a marshmallow filling with like a chocolate bun, right?
Yeah, essentially.
It's like a bigger Oreo, a bigger, softer Oreo.
There
that
you go.
I always thought
yeah,
about.
That's why you're
a good way to put it.
Those are great use of words. So Reading did it in 2017. And I think this is the first time we've seen another team in a different region, you know, adopt the same food identity. So Portland is like, oh, we're going to be the Maine Whoopies in a game in June this month. And they're actually playing Reading. And unfortunately, Reading is not also playing as the Whoopies. It's not like Whoopie versus Whoopie. Whoopie.
That would have been great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then Whoopi Goldberg could show up. And there's just so many opportunities to not really. That's about
it. Well, no, if you think about it, there's so many famous people named Whoopi. They would get a lot of them. So I think that's kind of interesting. They're battling for Whoopie Pie supremacy. And who among us hasn't dreamed of a battle for Whoopie Pie supremacy? I sure have. So we'll see who wins. Who really can lay claim to the Whoopie Pie? Reading, Pennsylvania, or Maine?
I hope the Red Sox and Phillies AA players know what exactly is on the line here when they play in this random game this summer.
I'm sure they all have June 21st.
Yeah.
Even guys who are maybe thinking about getting a call up, they're like, hey, can you do it on June 22nd? I got a battle for Whoopie supremacy first. You know, priorities here in my career. But, you know, that was one that was announced today. We got, Montgomery announced their promo schedule today and, saying it's like the year of bacon. And then there weren't any bacon promos on the schedule, so I was confused. But the team got in touch and said, you know, there's a lot more to come. Trust us. This will be the year of bacon in Montgomery.
And they call it the Biscuit Zodiac. Is that a thing they've done before?
No, and I don't actually know what that's a reference to. I should have asked them that, too.
I mean, the year of the bacon just means like, you know, the year zodiac sign. It's the year of the pig, for example.
I guess that's what they mean. It's and their weird team. There's the Chinese calendar, and I guess this is the biscuits calendar. It's the year of bacon.
Also, how is Lehigh Valley going to feel about this?
You know, I saw
a lot of people in their mentions trying to
right. They said something very magnanimous, you know, to the effect of like, you know, hey, there's room for more bacon in minor league baseball. We don't own bacon. We just embrace it, but we don't own it. We can't lay claim to being the only bacon team. So, yeah, more bacon in minor league baseball. You know, there's teams whose promo schedules I haven't even looked at yet. That's on my to-do list today to enter them. I know Carolina came out. Akron just came out. Hartford did theirs last night. Yeah, and Sam and I are looking at my Twitter feed, which is a great source of information, it turns out.
This reporter, Benjamin Hill.
Yeah, you should follow him. This dude's relentless. It's like, don't you write about anything else, dude? This is a little niche, but whatever. Two teams have unveiled Firefest promos, which, you know, are going to get a lot of attention, referencing that debacle of a music festival. And of course, it's back in the news 1 year later with the dueling documentaries on Netflix and Hulu. The Lexington Legends are doing a Firefest night on April 28th. And 2 days later, the Columbia Fireflies are doing a Firefest night. So, you know, we're going to get, you know, the cheese sandwiches at the concession stand, you know, claims to have celebrities showing up that won't show up, you know, maybe some tents on the concourse with waterlogged mattresses inside. I'm sure they'll be reaching out to the top influencers. These are the kind of promos that maybe don't, you know, result in a huge amount of uptick at the gate, but they do result in a huge amount of attention and press and just energy for the front office. And I am actually, though, curious to see what they do with it. It can't just be a press release promo. They're going to have to convert and do some fun things at the ballpark. So late April, that's one to pay attention to. Hartford.
Somebody needs to do a Billy McFarlane punchable face contest, look-alike contest.
A look-alike contest.
That dude, like if, well, although I don't know if anybody wants to admit they look like that dude.
Yeah.
So maybe not. Yeah. Let's, I don't want
to. Especially when you say he has a punchable face. Like, I wouldn't want to show up to the ballpark.
The most punchable
face. Yeah, and we don't advocate violence. We advocate forgiveness, compassion, and redemption.
Totally.
So how about a Billy McFarlane learning station and forgiveness?
Oh, there you go. Yeah, that's a way better idea. And it can be in the form of a federal prison.
Yeah.
Put him behind bars in the unused bullpen, and there you go.
Yeah, so a lot of potential, and you can tell even just, you know, the way we're talking right now, I can virtually guarantee you that this is a fun one in these respective front offices to brainstorm. And I think it speaks to when people, you know, work in minor league baseball, I think a lot of people like this, that you can say, hey, let's do this, and then actually do it and have fun with something absurd and, you know, pop culture relevant and what have you. And then the Hartford Yard Goats announced their promo schedule yesterday, and they've got a, you know, Brendan Mr. Rogers bobblehead where he's dressed like Mr. Rogers. They have a truly kind of nightmare-inducing goat jersey that's like screaming like out of the chest, almost like the goat was like inside the player, like in Aliens, and like it's bursting out screaming.
Yeah.
Maybe that's a little dramatic, but it's pretty strange.
My favorite detail about that is that to make it legal by minor league standards, there has to be a logo, right? So they put like an ear tag, the smallest, tiniest ear tag on this screaming goat that has the Hartford Yard Goats logo. And it stands out because it's yellow, so at least you know where it is. But they tried so hard, I bet. Like, how small can we get this?
Yeah, that's a good point. I didn't think of that explicitly, but yeah, we should have a contest or try to find like what theme jersey has the smallest logo that, you know, the powers that be will accept is still qualifying as a logo. Maybe you could do microscopic and you could just, you know, get like literally get a microscope and look underneath and say, see, the logo's there. All right, neither here nor there. But one more thing I did want to talk about with Hartford is in conjunction with the promo schedule, this is not a promo per se, but they became the first team in minor league baseball to outright ban peanuts at the ballpark out of trying to accommodate people who have peanut allergies, which, you know, can be very severe. And it's not just if you eat a peanut by accident, it's, you know, they're airborne in the, you know, the shells fly around. You know, they can be airborne in the stadium. They can cause severe reactions in people who have allergies. And that's an interesting move because, you know, what outside of a hot dog, you know, peanuts are so just tied up into the culture and the experience of seeing a baseball game. And so I think, you know, the reaction, of course, in the early going, a lot of people being like, how can you not have peanuts at a baseball game? And I get that, but I'm on board with this move because is someone's enjoyment of peanuts, like how many people need to enjoy peanuts to justify saying other people can essentially never come to a game because of their allergy? And it's an interesting debate. And I was saying this to Sam on the way up here. To me, it's analogous to the debate about netting. I mean, the same thing. Like I want to go to – if I'm going to my, you know, dream ballpark, I'll probably have some peanuts and I certainly don't want to look through a net. But is my preference outweigh the fact that if there's not a net, someone could get hurt or even killed? If there are peanuts, someone could have a very severe reaction that is possibly up to and including death. And I think it's an interesting, you know, debate to have, not just within the world of minor league baseball, but at what point does the enjoyment of the majority get outweighed by just how severely the minority is impacted? And, you know, it could get very philosophical, but it's interesting move by the Yard Goats. I support it. I think you can get through a baseball game without peanuts, even though peanuts are so, you know, tied up in the culture of the game.
Well, that's one of the sillier arguments too, is like, what are they going to sing during the seventh inning stretch? It's like, they'll still sing about it. It's just,
yeah, people don't have
the lyrics and have fun with it. I mean,
beer bats. What they need to replace it with. They have beer bats at Yard Goats games. That's all it needs to be. The whole song should be beer bats and shouldn't even have any other words.
Everybody just holds up their beer bats and just chants beer bats.
Yeah.
Beer bats.
Tyler, do you have a preliminary version of how this song would go? I'd love to hear it.
I'm workshopping some stuff. I don't want to roll anything out as of yet. You know, I've been in the studio all week trying to get it nailed down. But no, I think the point about it being very similar to the netting debate is spot on. And, you know, it's one of those things that I think everybody is super fired up about right now and will forget about by May, as we have seen in so many minor league baseball debates. But to me, and I was engaged in a conversation on Twitter today with a guy who said, you know, there are 12% of people in America are alcoholics and only 0.6% are allergic to peanuts. So if they banned alcohol at ballparks, that would be ridiculous. There would be an uproar. And I said, yeah, but like if you had a child who was allergic to peanuts and therefore could never go to a baseball game because of that, and then a team took a stand on something like this, wouldn't you feel good about the fact that that team was looking out for that kid? And it just seems like aside from the straw man of like banning alcohol and relating it to something like that, I just think like for a team to be proactive about this, I think is cool. And not only that, but to me, and maybe this is an overgeneralization, I feel like the people who are complaining about the Yard Goats banning peanuts at the ballpark would also be the first people to complain about how expensive peanuts are at the ballpark in the first place. It's like, if you're not going there and buying them, what is this really changing your enjoyment of the game that much for? I don't know. Yeah. It just seems everybody's fired up about it now. I don't think it's going to be much of an issue once we get into April and May. And beside the point, but also true, sunflower seeds are the superior ballpark snack anyway.
I would agree with that as well, to be honest. Okay. I mean, as much as
take that.
Yeah, as well.
Take that, peanut lovers. One other one notable from this week, the Durham Bulls announced a jersey that is fantastic.
Yeah, the
wait, Ben.
The Durham Lollygaggers. I don't have the date up on this, but Durham, I believe.
Of course I just did.
Yeah. I believe it was 2 days ago. Durham, Lollygagger night. There we go.
June 14th.
And that is a reference to, of course, Bull Durham. The Durham Bulls have obviously done a lot of promotions through the years related to Bull Durham. I mean, it made their reputation like a movie has made the reputation of no other team. And it's a huge part of their you know, their brand. And so now they're going even further and calling themselves the Lollygaggers, which is, of course, a reference to a famous lines of dialogue in the movie. Here it is right in front of me. But I can't really reenact it. I mean, you guys have seen Bull Durham, right? You guys, you lollygag around the infield. Anyway, skip. The word Lollygaggers is used quite a bit.
That makes you Larry. Lollygaggers.
There we go.
That was my favorite thing. Was in there on the Hit Bull Win blog, the official blog of the Durham Bulls. They embedded a tweet from actor Robert Wool, who played Larry in the movie. And he tweeted a Chris Kremer tweet about those jerseys and just said, "Oh my God." which is pretty great. So he's fired up for it.
Yeah, so that's a good one. June 14th got a lot of attention already. We'll continue to get attention. And, you know, as this conversation we're having shows, this is the time of year. We've been alluding to it over the last, you know, 6 weeks or so, 5 weeks, basically since 2019 started. Things have been trickling in, but now they are coming in at a steady rate. And I would expect that to continue throughout the rest of February. These kind of announcements, things are starting to actually ramp up, and it's starting to really feel like the season is coming instead of just sort of willing it to happen, or a lot of times in my case, willing it not to happen because I feel overwhelmed about it. But you know how it goes. One final thing I'd like to bring up that I think we wanted to touch on is yesterday, the Kannapolis Intimidators announced that they, in conjunction with moving into a new ballpark in 2020, will be rebranding, so they will no longer be the Intimidators. That name is a reference to the nickname of Dale Earnhardt Sr., the Intimidator, who I believe had an ownership share in the team when the team first, when the Intimidators first started over 20 years ago. So they will be rebranding, and as is often the case, especially on social media, the initial reaction was not good to this.
Well, and what I think was interesting about this initial reaction was it was this crossover reaction. I think Intimidators fans were to a degree upset about it, but we got tagged in a tweet from the NBC sports site NASCAR Talk, in which they had an article about it, and then it brought this wave of people who were NASCAR fans who were very upset with the Kannapolis Intimidators for this. But I think that the Intimidators' rationale for it is well thought out. Their I think it was their assistant AGM was quoted, or their assistant GM, their AGM was quoted in the story and said, like, there are millions of people out there who are Dale Earnhardt fans, but that's his legacy. That's not necessarily our legacy. Like, we appreciate those people. We appreciate that history. But those people are fans of his and fans of his career and what he did in his life. And for us, we have a different history than that. And that, I think, is understandable and justified. But that's going to be a difficult one to get through for them.
Yeah, definitely will. And, you know, Sam, who is just been phenomenal at pulling up the right things at the right times. You know, there was a tweet from Dale Earnhardt Jr. yesterday, you know, who quote tweeted the Kannapolis tweet, the Kannapolis Intimidators tweet announcing that they were changing their name. Dale Jr. quote tweets that and says, I remember Dale Jr. quote tweets the Intimidators and says, I remember how proud Dad was of this. What a shame it has to end. And, you know, that's his opinion. That's fine. But that's some heavy.
Got 4,000.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like, if you're not involved in the ownership.
Which they're not, which I kind of feel like.
It doesn't really seem fair that the franchise forever can only have that identity. And that's a difficult situation because it's A, not often that you have teams that are named after one person to begin with. B, especially not even in the sport that they play. But that's a tough situation, and you see it from both sides. It's difficult, especially if you're – I know Dale Earnhardt's daughter also tweeted something similar about how it was disappointing. But it's – you know, if you're not really involved with the team, how long does the team have to be of that identity and only of that identity?
Yeah, I feel the same way. I understand their emotional connection to it, and I'm not arguing with their opinions. But it doesn't really seem fair from a business perspective to kind of not hold them hostage, but to use that reputation of Dale Earnhardt Sr. to act like it's sacrosanct and you can't do anything with it.
Right.
It's a different sport. The family's no longer involved in the ownership. They're going to a new downtown ballpark, obviously want a new identity with that. And, you know, to be honest, you know, NASCAR fans and people who are so mad, look at the attendance of the Intimidators in recent years. It's not that great. If you really were supporting, you know, this NASCAR themed team, then you'd be there. And it's easy to be online, mad online, but it's a lot harder to actually put your money where your mouth is and do things and live your life in a way that actually supports the things you're mad about.
I will give Dale Jr. credit for this. Earlier today, he tweeted out that if a change is indeed imminent, maybe the team could go with Ironheads, which is what was another nickname for Dale Earnhardt. I don't think that addresses any of the issues you talked about. I think that continues to tie it in with Senior. I get that. Or they could go with the Cannons if they'd like to honor some history of the town itself, and then he hashtagged it Cannon Mills. That would be kind of cool. I mean, so it sounds like they're willing to participate, at least acknowledging what the issue is here. I wouldn't be surprised if they don't change the name, if they go like the way of the Hillcats. maybe a new look, something like that. I mean, remember on this podcast, we had this debate about what Lynchburg could do. They could tie it into something local with the faith-based, you know, area
love
around
apples.
There. What?
That's what I always remember. The love apples. Isn't that what one of Lynchburg's something about tomatoes?
It was. They had they had a very grandiose list of potential names.
Yes, they did.
Lamb chops and love apples.
Lamb chops is the one I remember.
Several other ones, and then but they kept Hillcats as a choice, and then they kept it. I've learned never to be totally surprised by what happens with these rebrandings. Yeah. Whether it's hey, we're gonna keep the original name, or hey. We've been debating about these five finalists for months, but we just went with something else entirely. You never know where it's going to go. So we'll see how this plays out. We have, you know, the better part of a year to see it play out.
And I think that's kind of the good thing here is that they've announced it this far out. It's not like, hey, we have a 3-month lead up to this. It's, you know, we've probably already chosen the team, but hey, you might as well have your say. This is a year. This is a real chance for fans to have their say on this. And, you know, it'll be a rollout this year. You know, if you want to support the Intimidators, like Ben said, you want them to keep that name. Okay, you have an entire season to show it and not just show it online. Show it with, you know, hat purchases. Show it by showing up to the ballpark in its last season. Ways to do this beyond just 140, 280 characters at a time.
Well, and I think one of the things that we've talked about from time to time with these rebrands, there's a guy in that Dale Jr. retweeted who said, you know, Dale Sr. is probably the only reason why anybody outside of this area has even heard of that team. But the Kannapolis Intimidators or the Kannapolis whatever they end up beings are not trying to cater to people outside that region. You're not, when you're a minor league baseball team, you're not building a national brand for the most part. You're trying to get people into your ballpark from your local region, buying your merchandise. And yes, to especially on the merchandise side, you want to sell some of that nationally. The way to do that nowadays in minor league baseball is to rebrand. But you're trying to build a local identity. So I don't think that argument really holds water. But whatever side you are on this, yeah, I mean, you can make yourself known, especially if you're in that area and support that team. I will say that I'm going to have to get one of those hats because that's been an underratedly strong logo in the time that I've worked in minor league baseball. I've always liked the Kannapolis logo. Ben, you just named that one of your favorites.
I did on when we had the staff roundup of favorite hats for National Hat Day. You know, what a wonderful holiday. I chose Kannapolis as number one. So even though I'm totally on board and understand why they want to change their name, I love the Angry K logo because it's a little bizarre and strange, and there's just nothing quite like it. If you haven't looked at the Kannapolis Intimidators logo recently, do yourself a favor and Google it because
it is pretty cool.
It lives in a world of its own. And I don't really buy hats hardly at all. I just sort of accumulate them randomly and don't wear them too much. But I will want a K hat for my, you know, for my collection, such as it is. That is a great cap, and I will be sad to see it go. That was my first reaction when I saw the team was changing its name. I'll be sad to see that K go. That said, if I was running this team, I would say it's time to see that K go. So I understand.
Right now, if you just type in K-A-N-N-A into Google, the third thing that comes up is Kannapolis Intimidators name change. So I guess the algorithms are seeing that it is making some news. Elsewhere around, I guess that's it for what we had listed for this week. But what else is coming up on the site / blog?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it will be related to what we're talking about, more details on some of those things. Probably build some features and blog posts around a lot of these interesting promotions coming up. So in general, it's just kind of like, you know, stay tuned, dude.
Yeah, I was going to say, with the gauntlet thrown down by a lot of these promos this week, I mean, it's going to be tough to top the Durham lollygaggers. But like, if this is where we're really starting promo season in earnest,
yeah,
I think the next 2, 3, 4 weeks is going to be really fun.
My prediction is we'll have plenty to talk about as we did this week. And I hope people enjoy hearing us talk about it and, you know, have opinions of their own. And, you know, if you want to share them, hopefully you know where to find us. Right now we're in the Chelsea Market, but don't find us there. Online, email, Twitter.
On the internet.
Yes.
Do it. He's Benjamin Hill. You can find him on Twitter himself at Ben's Biz. The blog is bensbiz.moblogs.com. Batting Around is up on the site right now. And as we get deeper and deeper into promo schedule season, we'll be talking more and more about it. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you, Tyler. And thank you, Sam. Sitting to my right, you held the mic with authority.
Another Bull Durham line. That's what I'm looking forward to. Sam and I were just discussing a new minor league signee. This is another thing that we'll have a lot of going toward pitchers and catchers reporting. Curtis Granderson signed a minor league contract with an invite to Major League Spring Training this week. Hunter Pence just signed a minor league contract. Hunter Pence signing a deal with the Texas Rangers. So some of those guys who are out there as of right now may – Curtis Granderson was with the Marlins, by the way. I don't think I acknowledge that. Those deals are – gonna be on the way. They might not be super exciting, but if you're thinking about the free agent stuff, those deals are starting to clock their way in as well. So it's happening. It's still an interesting offseason, shall
yeah.
we say.
Yeah, I don't
it's
think
happening.
I don't think Curtis Granderson should have gotten the minor league deal.
Yeah.
Especially from the Miami Marlins, who, you know, are just trying to fill outfield spots at this point. I like the signing. I think, you know, Granderson bringing him in could certainly help Miami. I just wish they would have given him a guaranteed major league contract that it might turn into that.
Yeah.
But one thing to remember with these minor league deals, especially for you minor league fans, and if you're listening to this podcast, I hope you're one of them. You know, you might think like, oh, Curtis Granderson signs a minor league deal with Miami. There's a decent chance he'll be in New Orleans. Probably not.
Probably
not just
not.
Because of he's probably going to make the majors, but if a lot of these minor league deals, they come with invites to spring training, and then they come with opt-outs often. So if the player doesn't think they're going to make the major league roster, they can just opt out, not take that assignment to AAA, try to find another deal elsewhere. Maybe they go to another minor league team, but it's just a better major league situation, something like that. But don't get too excited if you hear a minor league deal for somebody who's obviously a major league player. Don't be excited that they'll make your minor league city. Maybe they will. I don't want to rule it out.
Possible.
Yeah, it's a much smaller percentage than just the transactional loan would seem.
Yeah. So just some stuff to keep in mind as we get closer and closer to the start of the major league and minor league seasons. How about James Loney, by the way? Did you see that? Former Dodger James Loney signed a deal with an independent team as a pitcher.
Yeah.
He's like 36.
Two-way player, I think. I think he's still
going to do both. Oh, is he going to do? Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. So, and I know Matt Davidson has also signed with the Rangers today. I know there have been rumors about him. I think I brought this up on the podcast once. There have been rumors about him maybe going two ways. I don't know if the Rangers are really a team that would explore that. Maybe they will. Who knows? We'll see how they handle him in camp. But, you know, the Shohei Ohtani, Brendan McKay, there's some influence there and just giving guys these looks and seeing what could happen. James Loney, independent ball, not coming to a minor league stadium anytime soon. But, you know, if he proves himself in indie ball capable of doing both, you know, who knows? We'll see. We're still very much in the early days of this movement. But it is kind of exciting to see baseball change in this way, kind of organically. In a week that we've had so many discussions outside about potential rule changes and the DH coming to the NL and all that, the idea of the game changing organically in this way and for the better and with the more exciting is really cool, and I really like to see that.
It's pretty cool stuff. So you can follow all of the breaking news and more at MILB.com. You can find us on social media at MILB. Sam is at Sam Dykstra, MILB, and I am at Tyler Mon. And that'll do it for this week's episode of the show. We'll talk to you next week.
Okay. Picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.